1, correction, tape 2, side A. Sister Irma Corcoran.
The Indians then stopped their dancing, stuck away. And the town was saved. Many, many years later, when I was a sister, I was companion of Sister Mary St. Irene to Jamestown, North Dakota, where her brother was ill. And in the taxi on the way to the hospital, I looked out and I said, "That must be the row of hills my father told about, from which the men of the town watched the Indians doing the war dance down in the valley." And the cab driver turned around, he said, "I've heard the old timers of this town tell that story many a time." And I was thrilled and delighted, because Mother and I had always wondered how much of Father's imagination had crept into this wild story. And in between this, the spring of my junior year in college, they unveiled the monument, the Custer Monument, in commemoration of the massacre. And the University Congress was going on in Chicago. My mother wanted to come to Chicago for the University Congress, and my father wanted to go there and to stop on the way in Colorado and visit two of his sisters who were still living. Three. But finally, my mother gave in, because she knew it meant so much to my father. And we had a new car. We could drive only, I think, at, seriously, it was 35 miles an hour. Dreadful, the limitation for that distance. And I was allowed to take my exams early. And I left early, and we went west and first to Colorado Springs and then north. And, of course, for the Indians, it was the celebration of the last big Indian victory. And Indians came from all over the West, many of them in Cadillacs. They were ornamented with bright silk dresses, anything bright colored and shiny. And, of course, the white part of the program was all laudatory, the courage of Custer and so forth and so on. And we had an army captain and his family lived in a tent next to ours. We had a tent with us. And after one of the programs, my father turned around, and he said to Mother and me, "Custer was a skunk." It's interesting that now that is being said, but at that time, he was considered a hero. So, I had many interests and questions. But at Park, for the first 2 years, I still was bent on being a foreign correspondent. And I was going to transfer at the end, first I was going to transfer at the end of sophomore year to Medill. I had investigated, my father had said I could go to any school of journalism in the country I wanted to. And I had investigated. And I found out that the one that ranked highest was Columbia, Missouri. And the second was Pulitzer at Columbia University. And the third highest was Medill, Northwestern. But if you graduated from Adele, you were practically guaranteed a job on the Tribune. And I thought, huh, I'll transfer to Adele, get a job as copy girl at the Tribune. I never heard of a girl having that position, but it just never occurred to me that a girl couldn't get it. The copy person picks up the pile of material that's to go to the different departments, and she distributes that to the different departments. And in that way, I'd get a look at all of them, and they'd all get a look at me. Mm-hmm. And when an opening that I thought I could handle turned up, I'd apply for it. And then I gave myself to the age of 26, I think, to get a good start. Mm-hmm. And I met in the meantime, which was fun, this very dear friend of mine, whom I shall see a week from Friday, who was visiting me for a few days. She had gone to Cincinnati for high school, a Dominican school, a very good one. And then she had gone to, her mother was a widow, but she had two maiden sisters. And the three women had moved to Cedar Rapids, and Lucille had gone to Cove. And in the 2 or 3 days she was visiting me, a boy named Harry Hansen, who was at Cove, had a summer job selling, these kitchen utensils that they sell from homes. And he stopped at our house. Well, he was also a Cove student, and he and Lucille had quite a conversation. And I said, and he said he was going to transfer to Medill. And I said, oh, I'd have the same thing in mind. And so we had a great conversation about him. He was an awfully nice kid. And there was no question of any romantic interest, whatever, because both of us had that one aim. We were going to get into big time journalism. And in the meantime at Clark, because I had a lot of questions about Catholicism, so much of it just didn't make sense to me. And fortunately, the library stacks were open, and I spent hours on end sitting on the floor. I didn't have much trouble with most of the courses because I'd had pretty good foundation. I had awfully good high school work. Sitting on the floor between the stacks reading, and I read quite a lot of philosophy and theology, such as I could get my hands on. And I got very much interested in St. Teresa. And I read Teresa. I had gone to the University of Iowa. I was going to go for the whole summer, but I was in an automobile accident and got kind of mauled up in the middle of the summer, so I had only 6 weeks. I had gone down there to get Spanish because they weren't teaching it at Clark at the time. It was before all the excitement about Hispanic Americans came in. And they had no journalism at Clark, except a news writing course taught by Sister Mary Richard, who was a very fine teacher, but the only thing she knew about news writing was one course she had had during the summer at the University of Wisconsin. And I had been the high school reporter to the few newspapers, and also when I was a senior, I'd had the only practical experience. And so I went down there, and I took feature writing from a young graduate student. I didn't know that but he was a student at the time. His name was George Gallup. I had wonderful, hard grounding in beginning Spanish from an exchange professor from the University of Texas, woman. And then came the automobile accident, and I had time to think things over. And I had been reading, and because I had got very much interested in Spanish things, and I had read all of the works of the Spanish Saint Teresa, and Don Quixote, and some more Cervantes, and just odds and ends that way. And, but St. Teresa stuck very much in my mind. And other theology that I could get hold of. And I had read all of St. Augustine, or I had read the two books. And I wrote, I read Nietzsche's Suspect Zarathustra at the same time. I didn't get that at Clark. I got it at Clark's own public library. And I had gotten more and more convinced of the truth of the church. Mm-hmm. And by that time, even some of my high school friends and contemporaries weren't particularly close friends, had married and marriages had broken up. Things had just gone all awry. For a lot of people, and some of them nice kids that I had liked very much and gone around with a lot. And I thought there are a lot of things wrong with the world that this has the solution for. And if I could bring people to take seriously, to look seriously at Christianity as something more than just going to church on Sunday and singing hymns. That would be the most important thing I could do. In the meantime, my friend Lucille, she was really the perfect. She was pretty, she was bright, and she was so good. She just seemed to be naturally good. My mother used to say, why can't you be more like Lucia? And you know, the strange thing about it was that Lucille and I were great friends. We loved each other. We weren't a bit, I didn't hate her at all. You'd think I would have hated her. We had about the same IQs. There wasn't anything terribly emotional about our friendship. We were just good friends. And of course, too, my mother had taught for 14 years before she was married, and then she had gone into the store as a sort of assistant to her brother, who had a business that he had started around the turn of the century. And but when she was teaching, she had taught over in the Bear Creek neighborhood, which was the railroad Irish section of the county. See, these old communities have traditions that go way back. Mm-hmm. My father's family had come from the other side of the East-West Road, and they were more staid and serious and bookish, the Gormans. And I thought more and more there wasn't anybody I could really talk to about the problems that I had. But I decided that what I wanted to do, what I what God wanted me to do. Mm-hmm. I used to be kind of angry at him. I'd say, why don't you take Lucille? She's perfect. And it'd be awfully hard for me to get myself around to be the kind of person I need to be. And yet I felt that I was supposed to be a teacher in Catholic tradition. And so I stayed on the talk. And on account of taking these courses at Iowa and gotten a teacher certificate, because my mother was determined I would get one, she was so afraid that something would happen to her and my father. Mm-hmm. And my sister was retarded. She was a Down syndrome baby. Not of the worst sort, but bad enough that, you know, she would need someone to look after her. And my mother thought the one thing, and at that time about the only thing a girl could be was a nurse or a teacher. Mm-hmm. She wanted me to get the certificate. So I got it, but hell or high water, I was going to get liberal education. I did. And so I went on. Well, I had enough credit to all of this that I could have graduated at the end of my third year. But North Central, of course, would have questioned that. So I had to stay on for a semester. But I thought if I was going to the convent, going to leave my parents, my sister had died in the meantime. As they were getting old, I owed it to them to spend that last semester with them anyway. So I finished in January and went back for the commencement fanfare in May. And it was funny, I didn't consult any of the sisters about it. I have an idea they would have said, oh no. But it just didn't occur to me. I was thinking, this is the will of God for me. I wasn't awfully happy about it, I'm ashamed to say. But nevertheless, I had accumulated enough conviction that I thought my own feelings weren't that important. So I entered my mother's brother, my uncle, for whom I was named, was on a commission to settle damages, flood damages in Cascade, Iowa, which is a little bit, which is a is on the dividing line between two counties. Mm-hmm. And so one day when he was driving into Dubuque for a meeting and was concerned, I went with him. And I went to Clark to find out just what to do about being a BBM. Mm-hmm. And my mother and her first year of teaching had stayed with a handsome family, not related to my young friend at Cove, whose daughter had entered the BBMs when the next girl in the family was old enough to help her mother in the house, that is, when she was 8 years old. And Sister Maynard Sita was a sacristan at Clark in my day. She was very elderly by that time, and a darling my sister. So I thought, well, I'll ask her what I ought to do. So when I went boldly up to Clark, and I asked for Sister Maynard Sita, and I told her I'd made up my mind to enter the congregation, but it never occurred to me they wouldn't want me. And I wanted to know how you went about it. Mm-hmm. Of course, she was thrilled to pieces. And she went around to the dean, and the dean had liked me, strangely enough. She was a kind of oddball herself. and her father had been the governor of Nebraska. And I was always doing things, you know, that I wouldn't have done, probably nothing out of the way that I wouldn't have done had I gone through BVM, parochial school, and high school in Chicago. I had gone through a little country school in the sticks and to a small town high school. And so I just didn't know the rules. And she went and got the dean, and the dean was delighted. Only one girl in the class besides me was entering Mount Carmel in the fall. And she thought it was a kind of reflection on the college. So few girls were attracted to the congregation. And she immediately got one of the workmen to drive us over to Mount Carmel. And it just happened that my best friend had entered there. That had nothing to do with my entering at all. But she was the niece of the big bad boss of Kansas City. And she and I had, we'd get up at something like 5 in the morning during nice weather and play tennis and then go to the 6 o'clock mass or whatever. We called her Penny. Her name was Pendergast before. Well, anyway, I had the supply list, and Sister Mary, the dean, Sister Mary Baseline, had gotten all the stuff for me then, and she got Penny from the novitiate to come over and go over it with me and all that kind of thing. She was sympathetic enough to the two of us to understand us, and Penny and I were a lot alike and very good friends, and we just all over some of the things on the list of what we would bring with us, you know. But anyhow, I wound up with BVM. And when we were leaving, my father insisted on my driving into Dubuque, which was only about 50 miles, because it would be the last chance I'd have to drive a car. And when we got there, they said, "Why weren't you here last night?" And I said, "Why would I have been here last night? What was going on?" They said, "Well, anyone entering the park always spends the last night in the park. You don't." And I said, "Well, how would I know that? I didn't have any
being here. It wasn't on the list.
Covering of maybe nobody gave a damn about me." Well, anyway, they were very much annoyed, and it was terrible because my parents and I was just going to say goodbye to everybody, and then we were going to go and have a nice lunch by ourselves down at the Julian, which was the best place in town at that day, and then drive over to Mount Carmel. Well, nothing would do. We had to stay for lunch, and we did. And another of my classmates had driven up from her hometown to see me, and she was determined she was going to drive me over there. And here were my poor parents. Well, she made such a terrible fuss that we decided just to let it go, and I don't know why she should have. And we were good friends. But I think part of it, as I gathered from a letter later on, was that she had a dim feeling that she was supposed to do the same thing she didn't want, and she didn't. But anyway, we sit and father and mother and I said goodbye. And they drove on, and we drove on. And the portress took my suitcase from sister. My trunk had already been delivered there, and I just got a steamer trunk so there wouldn't be any danger of my accumulating stuff. Now I have a hospital. And she took my suitcase from Enid, who had carried it up the walk for me. And she kissed Enid, and she shook hands with me and said, "You'll come to see your little friend often, won't you?" And my little friend turned and tore down the walk as though the devil were after her. And I stood there in my black and white dress with the white lapels, because my kid cousins had cleaned out my wardrobe the day before and I didn't have anything else to wear. And my white stroller hat was a black bed. And sister said, "Oh, you're the one." And I said, "Yeah." So she took me around and set me down in the library, and there were other people there. And every so often, a novice or a professor still would come and get the young girl who was with them, and they would say goodbye. Finally, I was the only one there. And then Sister Mary Felpa, who had entered after her sophomore year, several, a couple of years younger than I, came in. And her household duty, no problem, was taking care of that library. And she looked and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I thought I was entering." And she said, "Oh, my God," and tore out. She came back with a postulant mistress, who was very much disturbed. People were in line to go into the dining room for supper. And here I was, when I had gone, she had married them all. People were lined up by height. So, anyway, I took off my hat, and I don't remember what happened to the suitcase. I just was brought down and poked in the line with people my height. We went into supper, and a redhead that passed out was seated across the table from me, and we had ham for dinner, supper. And I was trimming the fat off the ham and looking very distastefully at it and wondering if sisters had to eat the fat that was on the ham. And Mary kicked me under the table and said, "You're in the army now." And we laughed, the two of us laughed. And, anyway, I settled down to a year and a half of novitiate. And the last half was really great because we had Sister Mary Nestor for novice mistress. It was her first turn as novice mistress. But she was a very sensible woman with a good sense of humor and an understanding of oddballs. And we got along fine.
Throughout what you've been talking about has been this passion for reading, for literature, for in your curiosity. That has been impressive.
Yes.
And so then the education of women, I keep thinking about too.
Yes.
Which comes through very clearly.
At the age of 90, you have seen so many different varieties of people. And even without being a world traveler, you've seen so many places that any word just draws up a volume of memories. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to sort the two. Keep them in line. But when Sister Mary Justicia was our superior and president until 1936, that was the 6 years, that was the limit, and she was a great woman, very great woman. Then Sister Maria Consuela was brilliant, temperamental, but also a good schoolwoman in her way, was president. And she was determined to get as many advanced degrees as possible in communities. And she sent Sister Mary St. Irene, who was a friend of mine, the head of the French department, to Fordham, and me to Catholic University. And it seems to me she started somebody else. And even though we went on a shoestring, that was an awful lot of money.
Yes.
Not too long after the insult crash was another catastrophe financially in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 36. That had happened in 34, 35, up to which. And at Catholic University, I went in with this good background in the 16th